Hi folks, I'm Philip from YoJo.com, and today I'm interviewing actor Ren Roberts, who portrayed Duke in a series of live-action commercials from 1991 to 1993. All right, well, good evening, Mr. Roberts. Why don't we start with you telling us a bit about yourself?
I started out as an actor, probably, I don't know, years ago. I did a Pepsi commercial when I was about, 6 or 7 years old. And then, I moved to L.A., to become an actor, and basically I ended up getting married, had a daughter, and I left L.A., and after I left L.A., I kind of went to Vancouver, British Columbia.
Okay.
Because I heard the acting industry was pretty good up here. I had a sister who lived here.
Okay.
Well, I came up here, it would have been probably 1989, and I picked up an acting career here, started out on shows like 21 Jump Street. Geez, I don't even remember most of the names. Wise Guy. Oh, I haven't looked at my resume for a while, so I don't know.
We can look it up on the Internet Movie Database.
Yeah, somewhere. I ended up doing, you know, a lot of smaller roles, and in, I think it was 1990 or 91, I auditioned for Duke at G.I. Joe, because I just happened to have the perfect hair. It was a style. I had my hair blonde, and I ended up cutting it to have nothing to do with trying to look like anybody. That was just my style, and so I got called in for an audition. The audition process went on for about 5 months. Brought me in the first time, and basically had a look at me and, you know, said, "You're amazing, you're great, you're perfect." And then I didn't hear from them. Then I heard they were going in a different direction. They were going to, you know, go older, so they were auditioning a bunch of older guys. And then the next I heard they were going to go younger, so they were auditioning younger guys and all kinds of auditions. And I thought, oh, well, you know, one minute I heard I had it, the next minute I wasn't sure.
Kind of all over the place, huh?
I would meet up with friends of mine at the gym and find out that they'd auditioned for G.I. Joe, and okay, great. They're still auditioning for that, and I'd basically forgotten about it. And one morning I went to an audition, I think it was for a Pure Antiperspirant commercial, and it happened to be the same casting director that did G.I. Joe. And I came in, and she says, you think you'll be available to do this? And I said, well, of course I will. I mean, why wouldn't I? She says, well, you're doing G.I. Joe. I said, what do you mean I'm doing G.I. Joe? She says, no one told you? And I said, no. Well, yeah, they told me last Friday that you got it. And I'm like, well, great. Thanks for my agent for telling me.
So you found out you got the role by going to an audition for another role.
Well, not really. That's where I found out I got it, right? Because I basically had auditioned once, I think maybe twice. I went to a callback. It went on for months that they, you know, they were still auditioning people. And, like, I found out I got the role months down the road auditioning for something else because it just happened to be the same casting director. It was kind of like, okay, well, here I am. I got it. That's great. I didn't hear anything for, like, a week or two. Finally, someone called me up and said, we need you to come in for a fitting, and basically we need you to come in for a stunt course. And I'm like, what? And I come to find out that they've been hiring all these stunt guys to basically, they wanted somebody to be a G.I. Joe who was a stuntman. And I wasn't. And I didn't know it at the time, but Vancouver had a pretty, you know, pretty good-sized stunt community. When these stunt guys found out that an actor had gotten the lead role who had to do all these stunts, needless to say, they were less than pleased. So, you know, they basically had to give me a crash course in doing stunts. And none of them really wanted to. So they hired a stuntman by the name of Scott Nicholson. Really great guy. At that time, he was fairly inexperienced, or what they called inexperienced, what the rest of them would call inexperienced. He's a rather big guy now in the stunt community, but back then he wasn't, and he was a stunt coordinator. He was about my age at the time, and I gotta give that guy credit, because he basically taught me everything I know about, you know, how to take a fall, how to take a hit, how to do squibs, and all kinds of things. Then there was another stunt guy, which would have been on the second round of G.I. Joe commercials. That would have been, I think, 92. That's the one where we did the Air Commandos.
Yeah, I think that's 92, yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't really remember, but I know it was the second round. We didn't have Scott Nicholson that time. We had Betty Thomas, who was a stunt coordinator, and they were using Betty Thomas, and the guy who basically taught me was a guy by the name of Mitch. He taught me how to do an air ram, and an air ram is I don't know if you know much about stunts, but it's like a giant rat trap. You step on it, and it throws you. It's a catapult, like a mini catapult.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so they use it in explosions where guys are running, and the landmine goes off, and they fly 30 feet in the air. That's basically what an air ram is.
They use that a lot in the commercials, then.
Yeah, I learned right away. I mean, I had to. I mean, basically, when we started out, they taught me how to fight, and they taught me all kinds of different things that I would, you know, need to know. So, I mean, I probably spent, would have been about a week rehearsing the stuff we were going to shoot. And then I remember the first day I came on set, they had a studio, North Shore Studios. They're called Lionsgate now. Back then, they were Can-El Films. And they had this whole studio, the largest one there, which was Lot 3. They had all kinds of, they had five sets in there. They had this giant Cobra command center, and they had G.I. Joe command center, and they had this giant pool and this great big like desert scene, and that's where we shot the little helicopters. And the first day, this was the plasma tox campaign. What I had to do was I had to do this stunt where I get shot in the chest with an air cannon, and basically it's just a giant propane tank with a valve that they open all at once, so everything in the propane tank comes out at once. Of course, it's a propane tank just filled with air. And then they put a big, like, nozzle on it, like a Clorox bottle, right? And they fill the Clorox bottle that's cut open on the one end. They fill it full of, like, fake debris, which is basically all styrofoam. And then they shoot this at you, and it looks like a giant explosion because it hits you all at once, all the air does. And then it's supposed to blast you backwards. And then I got shot in the chest with a fire hose, which was this little, I think it came from the paralyzer. And it shoots me in the chest, and I have to tumble down this little ramp into a pool. Well, I remember I got there on the first day, and I saw this on the, what they do is they draw it out on boards.
Well, the storyboards, yeah.
Yeah, storyboards. And they drew all the storyboards up, and I'm looking at all this stuff. And I was kind of standing there. It was January. And I'm standing in there in my coat in the studio, and the big door's open, so it's kind of cold. And I see this doughboy pool, you know, like people have in their backyards. And they're filling it up, and it's got all this neat set around it. And I see them, you know, they're filling it up from a fire hydrant. It's January. And I remember the guy's looking at me, and he goes, "Oh, hey, how you doing?" I said, "I'm fine." He didn't know who I was. And I walked over, and I said, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Well, I'm filling up this tank, because some poor bastard has to go in there today." And I looked at him, and I said, "Well, I'm that poor bastard." And he goes, "Oh, so you're Ren. Oh, I'm sorry. Pleased to meet you, Ren." And I said, "I don't think you really are, because you're getting a kick out of filling up this pool." And they hadn't done it days before, so basically they'd taken my measurements a few days earlier for a wetsuit, because they said I'd be in and out of water a lot. So they made me a 3-mil wetsuit to put on under all my G.I. Joe stuff. The first day of shooting, I probably tried on 9 different costumes before all the Hasbro guys decided on which costume they were going to do. And they, and back then, they had this via satellite thing with some of their clients back in New York, and I had to go stand in a room for 2 other people that couldn't be there to agree on the costume I was going to wear. So that took about all morning. I think my first day of shooting was 19 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. And basically, I just got a flat rate of about $1,000 a day. You think, you know, guys who make commercials make a lot of money. I had a friend in Los Angeles that made a Burger King commercial just before I left L.A., and he made about $160,000, you know, because they get paid every time they show the commercial.
Yeah, residuals, yeah.
Well, I don't know how many times they showed my commercial, but I never got paid squat. I got $1,000 a day, and so did the kids that worked in the commercial with us at about the same time. One of the other guys, Cobra Commander, was played by a guy by the name of Roger Cross. He's the only one of us that I know that's really famous today. He's on 24 now, and he was on some movie called Mad Money with Queen Latifah, and he also did First Wave here in Vancouver.
Now, Cobra Commander appeared in commercials in 91 and 93. Was he in both those years or just one of them?
He was only in the first year. Okay. Cobra Commander in 93 had this weird mask because they changed him. He had this, it kind of looked like Ku Klux Klan, only a black hoodie. Because I remember we were all making fun of it. We thought it was quite the joke that, you know, it looked so different.
It does kind of look weird.
Well, it looked like a big black sock on his head. Right?
It splays outward at the bottom, too, like it's distended.
So basically, in 93, we had 2 different guys that actually played it. And I don't remember either of the names because they were both stunt guys. But in 91, the majority of the G.I. Joe stuff was done by, let me see, there was me, and there was Gerald Pates, who was a pretty famous stuntman now. Gerald Pates played, I don't remember, he was one of the G.I. Joe guys. He wasn't on Cobra side, he was on G.I. Joe. Again, this was the little helicopters.
Yeah, that's one of the ones we don't have, sorry.
I can't remember the name. We used to tease him about his name, too, because he had a really kind of interesting name, his character's name. Something like Free Fall. He played this character. There was Scott Nicholson, who I told you was the stunt coordinator. He actually played the guy I fight most of the time. One of the utility bad guys from Cobra. I broke his nose. I had to jump off a helicopter with the plasma tox and land on this little vehicle. Then I had to fight him on this vehicle. We were just rehearsing, so he didn't have his headgear on. Because if he had, it was all fiberglass, right? And pretty hard for him to see or breathe. And I jumped down onto the vehicle. They didn't have the vehicle on a track. They had it on pieces of plywood. The plywood kind of put down like roofing. One overlaps the next. So as they're dragging it along, because they were pulling it by hand, and three guys on the rigging were pulling a rope. And they're pulling this thing along, and every time it hit a bump, it would kind of stall and jerk. So I jumped onto this thing, and I was just barely trying to hold my balance while swinging and fighting. And just as I went to swing, it hit this little bump, and it got caught, so they yanked it. So I lunged forward, and Scott lunged forward at the same time. And it was just a perfect hit. I didn't even hit him very hard, but I hit him so perfectly that his nose was sitting sideways on his head.
Yeah, but I bet it filmed great.
He was not too happy. I felt terrible. I felt absolutely terrible, but it popped into the nose. So that was his battle scar. We have the fight scene. I don't know. You've seen all the commercials, I take it.
Well, the ones we have, and otherwise I'm relying on what I remember from being a kid, which really isn't much.
Yeah, because I got them all on tape somewhere. Yeah, they are on tape. They're not on disc.
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I do have them all. I think there was seven or nine in the first season, and most of them were that little helicopter. In 93, we did some more with the helicopter, but it was a completely sort of different helicopter, new and improved. Because what I do remember, and Hasbro's going to hate me for this, is they did the little helicopter, and they showed the kids pulling the string. They had a little pull string. The helicopter flies in the air.
Yeah, I had one.
Well, you pulled this thing, and the helicopter went up and straight down on its ass.
That's how I remember it working, pretty much.
Yeah, it worked like crap. Well, they have this fancy little helicopter that had been all taken apart and put back together, and it had a little motor in it that turned the blades. And they had three guys up on a rigging with fishing poles and fishing line, and the kid would pull the string, and the helicopter would soar through the air with the greatest of ease, because it was on a fishing line, with a little motor turning it.
I always wondered why mine never worked quite right.
They didn't work. They didn't work at all, because I remember, you know, they tried them like twice or three times, and I remember our director just went out of his head. John, oh geez. We all had a t-shirt that said, I survived G.I. John. And that was because John, the director, and I wish I could remember his last name. He was from Fireside Film. Great guy. Absolutely a great guy. Tough as nails, and he didn't stop shooting for anything. Because I got injured quite a few times on G.I. Joe, and like I said, Scott Nicholson, I broke his nose. I ended up with six stitches in the back of my hand, some stitches in my shoulder for something else I did. I don't even remember what it was. I just remember getting the injury, and I had the craft services guy put duct tape over it so it wouldn't bleed. Well, we've been there. Like I said, this was really tough. I mean, we've been there probably, you know, anywhere from 16 to 20 hours. And it was getting to be the end of the day, and at this point, people aren't even, you know, we weren't even nasty to each other anymore. Everything just became funny because of the crew and everybody was so exhausted. And I remember it was that time of day, and we had to get this shot, and there was just basically nothing we could do. So I had him put some duct tape on it, and I went to the hospital when they wrapped. And they stitched me up. And I remember coming the next day, and the director saying to me, he goes, I've got some stitches. I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, why didn't you tell anybody? And I'm like, well, why should I? We would have been here another 7 hours. So he was like, for days after that, bragging to everybody how Duke the real thing, because I'd gotten stitches and didn't tell anybody. Those little helicopters, they have this rigging. The guy who actually rigged Broadway's Peter Pan, they brought him in from New York to do the rigging of these helicopters. He was supposed to be the best in the world. The rigging was supposed to be something amazing. And now rigging is so different because, I mean, you've seen Crouching Tiger or Hidden Tiger flying, whatever it's called.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, they have all that neat sort of rigging nowadays. See, back then it was all basically pulleys and motors and mechanical. I was expecting the best guy in the world rigging, so this is going to be some cool stuff. It was just painful. because the rigging worked for about 5 minutes, and then it went down. Then it worked for about 5 more minutes, and then it went down. The problem was, it went down when we were in midair. The wonderful effects guy, a guy by the name of Al Benjamin, really great guy, he just figured, you know, we'd all be plenty comfortable because we'd be strapped into a rigging, and then the helicopter would be strapped into a separate rigging. So our weight wouldn't actually be on the helicopter. So he had a bar with foam on it. Like, literally one little round of foam, and it was a bar. If you have worn climbing gear, it's right in your crotch, and it pulls up so hard it feels like the world's worst helmet. Worse than that, the helicopter's weight, with your weight combined on this little foamy seat, was excruciating. I don't think I've ever, ever, ever had so much pain. I think, you know, I haven't had any more kids because of that. The rigging was just nasty. I mean, in 93, Al made a... He made some adjustments. Actually, in 91, he made some adjustments. He took mine apart that night when we wrapped for the next day, and he welded an old bicycle banana seat, and then he padded the seat up so it actually was more comfortable because you could lean back on it a little way. Yeah, I mean, it was a little better, but not much.
That's terrible.
In 93, he revamped the whole thing so the seat itself was actually, you know, like a Harley Davidson seat with the springs on it. So it was quite a bit more comfortable. Plus, the helicopter had its own motor in it. The other ones did too, but this was like a whole different thing. And I remember our plasma talk thing actually had, back then, what was supposed to be the newest, coolest thing, LED, like mini diode. And they didn't have any of that, so this thing was like huge expensive. This stupid little light was like $3,000 that fit inside this thing, and the battery for the bloody light was like one of those batteries that, remember the big flashlights? You used to have the great big square batteries in them.
Like gigantic 9 volts, yeah.
It was something like that, and they had a battery that they basically took apart and had to put back together to fit in the bottom of the plasmatox container so it would light up, because this was the only thing that could give it enough light to actually make the thing glow green. So I remember, they were bragging about how the plasmatox thing cost like $10,000. So don't drop it because it's the only one we have. They had a stunt one that was made out of rubber, but it didn't light up or anything. But I remember on the real one that, like, they just freaked every time. Like, the second they would yell cut, a guy would run up, and that was his whole job, was to take care of the plasma box. And he'd snatch it away from me so quick I didn't get a chance to see. I remember thinking that was pretty cool, the little plasma box thing. And they were forever fixing it and yelling at me because I was snapping the little, kind of like little sharp spearheads on the outside of it. You know, like a dog collar, sort of. They were all plastic, and those little things kept snapping off. This thing had 4 handles on it, and we were constantly, it was changing hands all the time. In midair, it was flying through the air. Someone was catching it, I was grabbing it, and I was fighting with it in one hand, and you name it. That poor little plasma dog thing got all kinds of beating, and we had one little model guy who had a complete headache doing this plasma dog thing.
This is kind of funny, because the plasmatox that you held and then the plasmatox that the kids played with looked nothing alike. I don't think you could actually buy a little plasmatox container at all. I don't think it was ever a toy. Effort for a prop.
I never knew that. I was always curious about what the toy ended up looking like. They ended up giving me a doll that was basically a mock-up. It was the first G.I. Joe that they'd ever made, the first Duke, and he was wearing forest gear. You know, not desert camo. He was wearing forest gear. And basically, he was hand-painted. So he was the first Duke I ever got. They had to hand-paint him, and basically, I think they put him together with... It was one of their other characters. They used the head and the torso of 2 different characters, and then they used the legs off another one. Because they didn't have, you know, a ready-made Duke.
You still have that?
So I actually do, somewhere. And I have the first edition Duke that's still in the box. Which is the one in the desert gear?
Yeah.
With the red and the helmet and all that?
Yeah, with the little rocket that he sits on, which always seems a little dangerous.
And that's the first one that actually has my face on the box, the rendering of my face.
Oh, yeah, they painted you on the picture itself?
Yeah, I'm right on the box, which I didn't get paid for. Also did a cover of Nickelodeon Magazine, because I remember, you know, I was reading some of your stuff. That was one of the thing they had, and... The poster. I don't have a copy of that poster. I gave one to my daughter, and I never saw it again because they only gave me 2. I saw it on the website, so I've asked Hasbro for stuff, and for years they shined me on and say, oh, sure, you know, no problem. I'll send you whatever you want, and they never did. Yeah, I always asked for a couple of those posters, and they said they were going to have tons of them. Plus, I had trading cards, but I ended up losing those because I didn't really care much for them. I did the toy fair in Chicago where they basically stood around, signed autographs at a little booth, and handed out the Upper Deck trading cards. I think that was in 93.
That's about the year they came out, yeah.
I think so, yeah, something like that. Lots of stories. Probably I would say the most fun I had was the first year because the director was so off the cuff. The best stunts happened in 93. We had another director, and his name was Phil. I don't remember his last name either. He actually worked for Richard Donner's film company, Donner Shuler. So he was one of those guys. I've never seen anything he did prior or even after that. So I don't know if he went anywhere or not. He may have, but I've never seen his name. Being an actor, you'd always look at directors' names and stuff. And I don't think I've seen any of his work after G.I. Joe. Yeah, the stunts were really good that year on 93 because we did a lot more stuff. I remember in 91, I think the biggest joke we had running around set was they used to joke about my hair. Because I had this perfect head of hair that, you know, I did myself. I wouldn't let anyone else do it because it was just really easy. All I had to do was just kind of slick it back, put a little gel in, hit it with a hair dryer, and then just barely brush the front up and it was done. Well, I remember I tried to get them to do it and they just couldn't get it. And they were playing with my hair for about 25 minutes. And I remember the director was screaming and screaming because I kept having to fall into the drink, right? They hung me from about 25 feet up with a styrofoam, what's left of, because I get shot out of the air. So what's left of my little G.I. Joe helicopter still strapped to my back, and they dropped me into the water. And they had to keep doing this, and every time I came up out of the water, I was all wet. But then 2 seconds later, I had to be dry again when they tried it the second time around, and they had to have dry clothes. So they had this dryer running 24/7 with four different outfits that they kept drying and putting on me. And I remember I taught the one lady how to do my hair, because the first time it took 25 minutes, and the director went absolutely hate. So we went back in the back room, and at the time, we had Unit 1, which was shooting some of the other stuff. Like General Hawk was sitting at this control command center. He's sitting in his little command center, and they were shooting it, and I kept hearing him, "Duke's in trouble. Call out the air commandos." And he kept saying it and saying it and saying it. "Duke's in trouble. Call out the air commandos. Duke's in trouble. Call out the air commandos." And he would say it different ways because the director would go, "No, no, say it like this. No, no, add a different inflection. Say it like this." So he kept screaming that, and I remember we were over there, and in between each take, we've got the blow dryer going on my hair. And they're like, and they're shutting it down, and the next time I hear, "Quiet, quiet, we're going to shoot, rolling." And I screamed at the top of my lungs, "Duke's in trouble, call out the hair commando." And it was a running joke for probably the next two seasons we did G.I. Joe, because my hair was, it was the perfect thing. The next year when I went to have my hair, it was actually looking dumb. They actually made me audition the next time around for G.I. Joe, for Duke, which I was really insulted. I was actually insulted. And I mean, you know, there's no small parts, only small actors, they say, but I was just really kind of offended.
Yeah.
But they made me come in and audition for it, right?
Yeah, I know. It would be weird to see suddenly a different guy.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought. But anyways, I came in, and I was a good sport. I came in, and I did the audition. I just remember standing in this lineup with all these guys. And I'm the tallest guy in the room. They lined us all up, and they basically ask you who you are, how tall you are, what your weight is, and who your agent is. And I was standing right in the middle of all these little 5'8", 5'9", 5'10 guys. Every scene was like, "My name's John Stewart. I'm 6'4", 285 pounds. And they get all the way down right to the middle of where I'm standing. And I said, "I'm Ren Roberts. I'm with Kirk Talent. And I am 6'2", and I am 265. And I said, "No, I really am." And I remember it was just a big joke because seriously, here are all these guys proclaiming to be something that they weren't, right?
Like, you can really fake height when they're right in front of you?
You can't, but I mean, I guess you can if there's nothing else to gauge it to.
Well, you think
and
the people asking the questions.
I was clearly the tallest guy in the room by like 4 inches, and I just thought that was a joke, right? Because I remember the camera guy was just snickering because he thought it was funny. I stuck behind 5 minutes after everyone else had left, and I just gave a shout out to everyone at Hasbro on the camera because I knew they were going to see the tape, which I won't tell you what I said. It was quite humorous. I don't even remember half these stories. It's been so long because I used to tell these stories all the time drinking with friends, and I don't remember half of them anymore. Because I remember I got two injuries. I broke two fingers, cracked a couple of ribs, got a couple sets of stitches a couple of times. We did this one, it would have been 93. I had to do this stunt where I had to bust through a wall because this robot gear I wear, what was it called?
Armor Tech?
Armor Tech, that's right. I had to wear this Armor Tech gear, which was actually just sticky foam. You know, that high-density foam? And they painted it all, and they glued it all together. So it was miserably uncomfortable. It was light. but you didn't have any mobility in. So when I tried to turn my head, I couldn't see more than like about 10 degrees in either direction. Not to mention the collar sat high enough to where my eyeballs could barely peer over it.
Yeah, you can kind of hardly see your face.
Yeah, I sent you that picture of Destro and I dancing. There's the picture of us doing the waltz as we were in between takes. Destro was a guy by the name of Sonny Sirulik, stunt guy. I really like Sonny. Sonny's one of my favorite guys.
Was he always Destro?
He was always Destro. He also did another Hasbro commercial where he played a wrestler for their little Goonies. I forget what the commercial was. We shot it all at the same time. It was an extra day, and it was another product they had, little freaky little toys, and I forget what they were. They kind of went along the Stretch Armstrong thing that Hasbro revived. I don't remember what it was. I wish I could. Anyways, he played this Stretch Armstrong sort of wrestler guy as well for Hasbro. Friend of mine was Dale Moore. He played Gung Ho. We called him Big Ho because he was always chatting the women up. Dale Moore, he's a pretty cool guy. I've known him for a few years as well. And basically, they went through, I would say, probably 50 guys looking for a guy who could play him. And this guy just happened to be an actor friend of mine who wasn't catching a break. And I basically said, hey, I know a guy who could play this, because they'd exhausted all avenues. And they looked at all these people, and next thing you know, here we are shooting, and basically they didn't have a Gung Ho. So I said, I know a guy, and they said, well, good, can he be here tomorrow? So I said, yeah, he's the only other guy I knew that was 6'2 and fairly built, right? So he showed up the next day just happy as peach that he was getting paid. And they put a mustache on him, and he became Gung Ho, and he got 10 days out of it. Dorothy, I can't remember her last name, she played the girl that was on the poster.
Scarlet.
Yep, and I can't remember, I wish I could remember her last name. Mike, he worked for Betty, even the rigger for the VRM. Mike Mitchell, he played Cobra Commander part of the time in 93, and he played one of the other characters, and I don't remember. And then we had that character Snowdrift, or Ice Tone, or
Frostbite, maybe?
No, I don't remember. But he was another guy that I know, but I can't remember his name. Really, really tough little stuntman. Was married to Mario Van People's little sister. And I wish I could remember his name. I think it's Laurel. His name's Laurel, but I don't remember his last name. He's a really tough cat. He did the movie The Hitman, the first one with Chuck Norris. And he played a guy there, and they basically had one of the guys point a gun at him and shoot him. And part of the end of the gun actually blew off, just like getting shot in the chest. So he's probably one of the toughest guys I've ever known. He had a piece of his gun lodged in his liver from that movie.
Well, that's a hell of a story.
Yeah, seriously. And I mean, really tough guy. Really an incredible guy, too. The nicest of guys. And he's still a really talented stuntman. He does a lot of coordinating nowadays. And I wish I could remember his name. I've known him for a few years as well. Mostly did stunts. Short little guy. I remember there was one of the execs from Hasbro I didn't really like. We were sitting around the table one day, and they kept talking about G.I. Joe the movie. Someday we're going to do this movie. And I said, you know, that would be so cool. That would probably be the biggest break of my life. And the one guy from Hasbro turned and looked at me and said, yeah, well, we'd probably use a real actor.
Ouch.
Yeah, I know. And that's what I said. I said, ouch. And I was so pissed off, I almost walked off set. Because I was just completely like, I couldn't believe someone would actually say that. And this was in 93, you know? So I felt like going, you know those stitches? I think I won $1,000 a stitch. I learned a lot. I probably could have shut my mouth and done a lot better. A lot of stuntmen didn't like me because I was, you know, they all had to teach me. And then for me to turn around and keep on saying, well, I'm an actor. I want to be an actor. You guys do your stunts and I'll do my acting. And I had a lot of people calling me to do stunts, and I basically turned it down. If I had the chance to do it over, I think I probably would have followed the path that was set out for me. Because I really wanted to be an actor, but I mean, it was kind of in the cards to be a stuntman because nobody gets that kind of training for free, you know? And Basically, I had some of the best teach me their craft because they had to. Yeah, I kind of feel a little bit bad about that, but I'm pretty happy now. I mean, I'm a home inspector. That's what I do. I'm not much of an actor anymore. I did a role 2 years ago where I played a wife beater in a movie called The Secrets of Comfort House. A guy named Harley, really nice guy, beat his wife up, and I get killed. I get what I deserve. Okay. That's probably the largest role I've had in a while, and right now I'm not talking to my agent, so I haven't even gone out and auditioned for quite a while, and the movie industry's picked up quite a bit here. They love to shoot here because it's cheap. But yeah, like I said, now I'm a home inspector, because I've been in construction on and off. That's how you subsidize being an actor, right?
That or waiting tables.
You either do that or waitering or Or if you were like me, you know, you become a personal trainer. And I didn't do any personal training because I just didn't like to, because I always found that personal trainers were always the smallest guys in the gym. Trying to tell me how to lift weight. I'm a home inspector now. I really enjoy doing it, but I'm getting into the pet industry. My wife and I are opening a shop, a little mom-and-pop shop. It's called Dog Town. We're mostly holistic quality dog foods and pet supplies, mostly for dogs, smaller dogs, big dogs, small dogs, doesn't matter, but mostly sort of a boutique dog shop. So I'm going to try my hand at being a merchant, and I know a lot of people are telling you, oh, it's not the best time, there's a recession. Well, there's a big recession in the U.S. right now. It's not as bad as people are making out in Canada. I think we're doing all right. I actually came upon your guys' site from a friend of mine. He's just a real computer geek, right? And he loves to play on his computer, and he was always talking about, because he teasing me about my acting career, because I was always getting calls for these stupid little walk-on roles. And one day, it's like, I always played the guy that was like, you down the hall and to the left, sir. Guard number one, bouncer number two, or henchman number five. He was always teasing me about stuff he heard that I was in, and he'd hear some story I was telling, he'd go, I never see you on TV, man. You're full of crap. You weren't on TV. And I told him I did G.I. Joe, and he never really believed it. And he was playing around online, would have been about a week ago or so, and then he sent me this link. He said, dude, you gotta check this out. I sat up till 2 a.m. watching these commercials that they had, and you were in most of them. And I'm like, yeah, well, I told you I was G.I. Joe. And I think you remember, there is no G.I. Joe. I mean, G.I. Joe's a group, so I was duped, because everyone was always saying it, G.I. Joe. We were shooting, and it would have been in 93, I was doing a movie with Richard Grieco. The movie was called Born to Run. And I played this character named Tattoo, and we had to shoot all night. And I had to shoot G.I. Joe during the day, and they had me on a real strict schedule because I had to do both at the same time. So basically, I was working around the clock. So I was doing G.I. Joe all day, starting at 6 a.m. and shooting till it was dark. And then I got on set 2 hours behind everyone else on Born to Run, because most of our stuff was shot at night with all these racing scenes at night. I went to do this, and I had a day off from G.I. Joe, and I got booked on another commercial for Ocean Spray cranberry juice or something. All I remember is I had to drive this car. No, Speedy Breaking Muscle. I had to drive the car, and basically the camera is a jalopy that's going making all this noise, and it pulls up next to me. And I'm driving this Corvette, and the Corvette doesn't make any noise at all. So basically, you know, and I turn and I give him a dirty look, like, geez, man, go to Speedy Breaking Muscle. I remember I'm shooting this commercial, and we're shooting it in this tiny little neighborhood where it was really quiet. I wasn't getting any sleep because I've been working all night the night before. They had a Winnebago, so they let me sleep in the Winnebago in between takes. And I remember I hear all this noise outside, and I woke up and I'm just dead tired. I was asleep, and I could hear all this noise. I'd never heard so much noise in my life, and screaming, and I was like, geez, what is all that racket? And I can faintly make out, we want Duke, we want Duke. I'm like, what the hell? And I open the door, and there's like 1,000 kids out there surrounding the Winnebago, because one of the crew guys had made the mistake saying we have Duke of G.I. Joe here in a neighborhood that was like just had the ice cream wagon go by. So, yeah, it was pretty interesting because the word spread like wildfire, and needless to say, we had to shut down the set because we couldn't shoot. So that was my first taste of fame, I think, of G.I. Joe, because nobody knew me except for little kids. I'd be in a lineup of a bank, and I'd see some woman, and she'd be standing there, and she'd have her little kid with her, and her kid's talking, it's Duke. No, son, leave that alone. No, really, it's him. And she'd turn around and go, I'm sorry, sir, but this guy really seems to think that you're Duke of G.I. Joe. And I said, well, I hate to burst your bubble, man, but I am. And she goes, no. I said, yeah, we actually shot those commercials here in Vancouver. So, yeah, I was famous between 6 and 12-year-olds. All over the place, but no one else knew who I was.
Well, that was my age group.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. I mean, I'd walk around the mall or something, and a lot of kids always knew who I was. The first year, I think the most interesting thing that happened with the first round of Hasbro commercials that we made, I think we did 11 that year. That whole campaign got shot down, and it took them... No, they didn't even show them. That's right. The first did because the ground war broke out in Iraq. They didn't want, you know, the whole Desert Storm thing to interfere when they didn't. They thought the G.I. Joe thing, because of Vietnam and everything else, it would be pretty unpopular. Not cool to bring G.I. Joe out. Remember that happened because they came back the next year and they shot another round of about 9 commercials. which kind of ended up in the same season, but it was actually shot the next year. It was the same continuation of commercials, but they actually hadn't showed the first set of 7 or 9 that we shot. So we did 2 years in a row before they ever started airing, and that was because of the war. They kind of started feeling it out, and the next year, they didn't even want to do it. And somewhere along the line, at one point, they did a consensus or some sort of, you know, study, and they figured out that, you know, more Americans were kind of proud at that point, proud of their soldiers and showing some patriotism. So they thought, well, maybe it's a good idea, and they started to do a study on it, and I think about halfway through the study, they decided it was a good idea, and they did the next set of commercials. And then they started showing them, and they got a really good response from them. Yeah, I remember them being quite scared to show the first set, because I was kind of, you know, waiting and waiting and waiting to see the first commercial, and I never did.
Did you ever get a copy of those first commercials? The ones that didn't air?
The ones that they didn't air, no, actually, all the copies I got are everything that aired. Believe it or not, I got one tape that may actually, there might be two or a couple on there that might not have aired, because they sent me a tape. The first year, basically everything I got, I taped myself up on television. I basically set my VCR for, you know, cartoon time.
Saturday morning or something, yeah.
Yeah, in the morning and in the evenings, hoping to catch one. And then I caught it, and I put it on a reel. So that's how I ended up with the first set of commercials. The second set, they sent me a tape, and I believe the third set they did. So I'm not sure how many did air or not, but whatever I've got on tape may or may not have aired. I think I saw most of them. The only one I personally ever saw was Real American Heroes Don't Do Drugs.
Oh, the Drug Elimination Force.
The Drug Elimination Force. That's the only one. And I remember I made $1,500 that day, and I told Hasbro I was going to donate that $1,500 because I was on Big Brothers. I had a little brother. I was a big brother. So I donated to Big Brothers of Canada, and I told Hasbro if they would double it, I'd donate my day's pay. And Hasbro agreed. So little brother's got $3,000, I think, $4,500. It was good because I didn't mind doing that day because it was kind of something I really felt pretty strongly about when I did do it, because, yeah, it was a campaign I really liked from G.I. Joe. It was one of the things I really enjoyed doing. I was just disappointed that they didn't put me in the Navy White. If they had this really cool thing put out, and they just thought I looked too much like a sissy in it, so they just made me wear my regular G.I. Joe stuff. I thought I would sharpen the uniform, but, you know, who am I to say? They pay experts for that, and they pay experts to do my hair. It was really funny, too, because the second year, my hair wasn't done, right? I'd been wearing it a different style. So I didn't want somebody to cut my hair like a refugee. And basically, the woman who was on set that was going to cut my hair, I told G.I. Joe, I said, if she cuts it and she messes it up, it'll never be right. So I said, you know what? I can just go to a barber. There's a barber I use downtown. He charges like $10, and he cuts my hair perfect. And he's like 60 years old. He's been doing it for 50 years. And I said, this is the guy. And it was really, really cool, because I remember I showed up at 7 a.m. the next morning, and they had him there. They actually went down and paid a day off of work for him to come down to set and cut my hair for me. So they actually brought him down to cut my hair. So I was, you know, I kind of thought, well, that's pretty big of them, you know? Now, when it came to doing my hair or fixing my outfit, no problem. It was fun. And, like, I haven't really kept up on most of the G.I. Joe stuff, other than, like, I did the Toy Fair in Chicago for the Upper Deck trading cards. I got to meet William Shatner in Chicago, because he happened to be there doing the Upper Deck for Star Trek. And I also met Glenn A. Larson from the Far Side. He was actually there signing autographs, and I can't remember his name, the guy who does Calvin and Hobbes.
Bill Watterson.
Yeah, he was there as well, and I got a picture with him, and I remember, like, he came up to me with his grandson. He wanted Duke to hold his grandson. So he caught a picture of me with the grandson, and then he just goes away, because that was my job, was to stand there, sign autographs, and give out pictures. I remember the girls going, whoa, you know who that was? You know who that was? And I'm like, no. And she goes, that's the guy who does Calvin and Hobbes. So I called him back and said, can I have a picture for myself? I'm sorry I didn't know who you were. So somewhere, yeah, I have a picture of him. Yeah, it was kind of interesting. And then I got to go throw in a baseball at a White Sox game. Yeah, I used to pitch in Little League when I was younger. And I threw a dirt ball. Can you believe it? I'm in front of like 30,000 people and I throw a dirt ball.
Well, I'm sure that happens more often than people admit.
So I threw that and I threw a dirt ball and I was just like, ah, I can't believe I did that. So they had some guy sign my ball and I didn't think that was good enough, so I walked over to the dugout and had the whole entire White Sox team, including the Pudge, sign my ball. Because I was out on the field, so I thought, hey, I can just walk over to the dugout. I might get tackled by security, but who knows? So I walked over there, they signed my ball, so that was kind of cool. And then I was doing, in 93, I was doing a third installment of commercials, and they stopped everything right before we started shooting after lunch, and they said, we have an announcement to make. And it's like, where's Ren? Get Ren up here. So I walk over there, and they said, we have a presentation for Ren, because Ren told us that how he used to pitch in Little League, and he's a championship pitcher, and how great he was. Well, we have an award from him. It's called the Dirtball Duke Award. And they made me this little model with a baseball that was half worn down in a big pile of dirt. And it was a little plaque. I don't have that anymore. I want that stuff because I led a pretty transient life. Disappeared. But I wish I still had that today. I'd take a picture of it and show it to you. Hasbro gave that to me, the Dirtball Duke Award.
Did you get to keep anything from the filming?
Yeah, I actually did. I kept one of the plasma containers. I turned it into an aquarium, a fish tank. And I got to keep this piece of a wall that had this cobra head on it. It was like a big, giant piece of steel, but it wasn't. It was obviously just vacuum form. But it was really cool. It was all painted up like it was solid brass or something, right? Or solid bronze. And it had these big red eyes, big cobra fangs, and it was like this big plaque, right? And it fit in this wall of this castle, Cobra's Castle, Command Center. What I wanted was they had these four cobra heads that were carved out of styrofoam, these giant heads that had the eyes that lit up. And there was four of them, one on each corner of the castle. I wanted one of those, but they wouldn't give one to me. They did give me a plasma tox container, one of the bigger ones. The thing was, I don't know, probably about 25 gallons. Had a big cobra insignia painted on the side of it. And I actually was big into fish, so I kind of built this big stack in the middle and designed my own filter for it and put the top on it, set a light up inside of it, put it in front of this wall. But that's one of the things I did have. It's gone now because, again, moving from place to place, I ended up giving it away to somebody. And I gave that plot to somebody else. I think he threw it out because he gave his kid nightmares or something because the cobra head was kind of scary looking.
Oh, what a shame.
I had a t-shirt that they actually made for all of us. I Survived G.I. Joe. It would have been the second season. It had a big cobra insignia on it and G.I. Joe on top. The first year, I wish I still had that t-shirt. I'm one of those guys who wears t-shirts. I don't save them. I just wore it, and I wore it in the gym, and it's gone now. And I wish I still had it. It was a giant Band-Aid with the G.I. Joe insignia on it. And I Survived G.I. Johnny. The one son that broke his nose, another one of the riggers got hit in the head with one of the lights. Another guy got hit in the head with his camera. One of the cameras was on a little bungee system, and the camera slipped off the rigging, and the guy was holding it, and it kind of bounced out of his hand and flew out of his hand because it was on a bungee, right? He was using it so he didn't have to have the full weight of the camera. But when he got hit, he tripped, and he kind of let go of the camera. The camera swung up and flew across the room and hit somebody in the head, and it cracked a $12,000 Zeiss lens. I remember G.I. Joe was just choked. Hasbro was completely choked about that. You know, forget the guy who gets 9 stitches in his head from the camera. It was more about, you know, his stupid head broke the lens. The next year was really tough with G.I. Joe. They had little stricter regulations. They had to make sure that all of us were. So they have fire codes because they had a fireman, like, on set because of the first two. They had all these explosions and stuff there that were a little more dangerous. I think somebody squealed. You know, one of the lighting techs or security guards or somebody, because, you know, it was a pretty good close set. You know, the doors opened all the time because they used one of those great big lift things. There were three of them, and they were all propane powered. So at some point, you got to open the doors to let the fumes out. So they kept cranking the doors open, and every now and then someone would sneak in and start taking pictures, you know, because they were always curious, because, I mean, we were the only closed set. You know, they were shooting other Kenmel productions, but we were the only closed set. I had to run through a wall with the Armatech gear. They had this wall, and they made it out of lead, you know, like that paper lead. They kind of scored up, so when I run into it and I actually hit it, I break through, and the edges of the wall peel outward because it's paper lead, so it gives it the impression that I just broke through solid steel. Because I'm flying through the air on my little helicopter, and I basically jump off my helicopter and jump right through this robot's head. And I go in, and I start messing up his brain, right? But that's how I get into his head, is I basically run into him, and I fly through his head. Because the Armatech gear makes me basically invincible. So I bust through this little wall. We have this set up. We only had three walls, three of these lead walls. The first one, they hadn't scored it very well. It was about 6 a.m., and we've been shooting for about 19 hours straight. I remember I was just exhausted, because half the time, I'm sitting around waiting to shoot something while they're setting up a shot, right? And, you know, you're kind of in and out, and, you know, five minutes, you know, get Ren up, make sure he's not sleeping, and, you know, get sleep out of his eyes, get him all prepped and ready, and then, you know, an hour and a half goes by. I fall asleep again. It's like, oh, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, get him ready. So I'm up and ready and still awaiting, right? The motorcycle guys, motorcycle kept breaking down. He had to do his jump, and I had to do his other things. So they kept trying to shoot two or three things at the same time to at least keep going. And they would shoot some of these things over and over and over. So the whole time I sat there on set waiting. Some days I sat on set a whole day and didn't shoot at all, but I was sitting around with my gear on, right? But I remember I've been waiting all afternoon and then all evening to shoot this one shot, and it turned out that we went right through the night. It was like 6 a.m. in the morning. So they get me all in this gear, and the gear is, like I told you, painful. But at least I could just wear my suit under it, and then I could put the... I was walking around in a wetsuit, which was by no means comfortable because it's hot. I was sweating like a pig inside this wetsuit. And the wetsuit's mostly for color because it's blue. And then they put the blue G.I. Joe, you know, foam armor tech on me. So I was running around in this wetsuit because they wanted me 5 minutes ready. I probably dropped about 30 pounds just sweating in this stupid wetsuit because I looked like I was running around in my underwear. And it's a full wetsuit because it's arms and everything, and then they just basically have all this Velcro gear that they put on me. Once it's actually on me, they have to hot glue pieces of it together. So when it's on me, it's pretty much on me, you know, and they can't take it off. You know, several times I would wait with this stuff on for at least an hour. And then finally it's like, oh, we're not going to get to it. So then they peel it all off me again. The director goes, oh, is Ren ready? Oh, what the hell happened? He was ready 5 minutes ago. Well, he's been in the stuff for like 2 hours, and he passed out from heat exhaustion. And at least if I had the wetsuit on and not the rest of the gear, I could unzip it and pull the wetsuit down to my waist so my skin could breathe. I was really tired, not to mention that I was really dehydrated. And I had to run through this stupid wall, so they get all this gear on me, and I go full tilt. And they're like, action! And they're on the other side, right? And I'm in the back, and I'm running full tilt as fast as I can. And I hit this stupid wall dead on, and I bounced off it, and fell straight backwards like, son. Everybody's, any day now, Ren, and I was out. I was out cold. It knocked the wind out of me. Not only that, it knocked me unconscious because I ran into it at full force, expecting I was going to go right through it. So as soon as I'm semi-conscious, I jumped up because I want to see the rush right away, see what happened, right? So they're like, action! And you see a little, the wall just vibrated slightly. That was it. No nuke, nothing, just a little bit. And everybody on the backside actually saw that I hit the wall and bounced right off it, right? So everybody was killing themselves laughing. I said, if you guys had the camera on the other side, you would have had a great time. Because, I mean, all the humor was back there, I'm sure. So the next time they scored the wall up, and again, I bounced halfway through it. I did get partway through it, and they couldn't get me through it. So the next time, they had two stunt guys grab either arm, and they basically catapulted me through it to get me to actually go right through it. So yeah, I got a little scratched up from the lead, I gotta admit. It was all in good fun. I mean, I was young then, so I didn't mind doing half that stuff. It was pretty good education.
Do you know if they had anything planned for 94? Offhand, I know there's at least one commercial they did that had live action, but most of them weren't.
From what I knew, they were going to come back, and they didn't because they basically talked to my agent. We kind of had a bit of a falling out because in 93, when we were shooting one set of commercials, they basically said that, you know, I'm going to be shooting next week. So I said, positively. They said, positively. I said, can you move it back another week? Well, no, we got millions of dollars in this, and on. And I said, well, I booked an episode of Highlander. So, I mean, I've got to do the 4 days on Highlander. I'm sorry, I can't do it. So they said, well, you know, we really, really want you to do it. I said, fine, you want me to do it? You pay me what I would have made on Highlander. We went back and forth probably for about 4 days, and I gave up Highlander. G.I. Joe calls me the next week and said, we're not going to actually need you till next week. I said, great, I gave up 4 days on Highlander. Thank you very much. So I didn't get to shoot on Highlander, and I didn't get to make the money I would have made on Highlander because, you know, if you're shooting a union show like Highlander or 21 Jump Street or any one of those shows, you never work just 8 hours. You get your 8 hours, then you get time and a half, double time, and triple time, and, you know, it just keeps on adding up. Plus, you get your lunch money, you get your costume fittings, and it turns into be a lot more money than what I would have been making on G.I. Joe. I had to scream and yell, and my agent was she didn't do any of this. So I ended up looking like the bad guy, you know, the cheesy little guy, the little actor who wants his money. I showed up the next week, and they said, well, I'm sorry, our producers rejected your idea. And I remember going, oh, that's nice. And I had all my makeup on and my gear on, and I went back upstairs, and I came downstairs. I was in my street clothes, and I said, I'll see you guys later. And they're like, what? I said, well, I'm not working today. And they're like, what do you mean? I said, well, you're not going to pay me for what I would have made on Highlander, so I'm not working. well, you can't do that. I said, well, sure I can. You didn't want to pay me. We had an agreement, and basically now you're saying your producers won't pay for it? Well, then guess what? I'm not here today. I had a check in 10 minutes. Only thing is I only got paid for 8 hours. And no stunt adjustments or anything else that I would have made on Highlander, because basically that's what union rules say.
We weren't doing a union, so they could pay me any amount they really saw fit. So ever since then, they were treating me really badly. Anything came up, it was always Ren's fault.
And I don't have any hard feelings towards Hasbro. I mean, they did what they did because everything was about money.
Well, they're a business.
But you got to think of the other guy on the other end, the guy who basically blood, sweat, and tears for what they got on film. And the second they didn't need me anymore, it was like no big deal. So when the next year came around, I'm sure they had a big debate on whether to use or not. I don't know what happened after that, but basically the whole campaign kind of went south, but I'm not saying that's why it went south. I don't know. I don't know if there wasn't any money in it or anything. I don't know. If I had it to do over again, I would have had a different agent, because then my agent would have done the argument. It wouldn't have been me. I have some regrets. I mean, that really put me down in this industry. I mean, I should have just shut up and smiled. But, you know, when you're living from check to check and you're doing construction work and you're hoping for that G.I. Joe check to come in, it's pretty hard to do, really. I mean, I was looking forward to the money and I was looking forward to what I was going to get, but I had to fight for every single little dime because that was my next check. These guys were worried about what they were going to eat for dinner. They brought me out to dinner once in Chicago, and the whole bill for the meal was $6,000 for 9 people. And the only way we got into the restaurant is because I was dressed like Duke. They didn't have reservations. And the maitre d' actually had a grandson who wanted to meet me. So he got his picture taken with me, and they actually let us in. Here I am sitting in this restaurant, and I think the name of the place was La Terraza or La Torina or something like that. And once I did get into the restaurant, they actually brought me a tie. I was dressed as G.I. Joe without the grenades and stuff on. I'm wearing this Desert Storm outfit, and they made me wear a tie. Because that was their policy, right?
Well, thank you for your time.
No worries.
I'm sure we'll keep in touch.
Yeah, please do, you know? Please do. I mean, you know, I'm more than willing to talk about the good times, and, you know, I'll remember other stories. Your site's great, by the way. You guys have made an incredible site.
Well, I wish I could take all the credit for it, but it's been a whole bunch of people over the years.
You know, it really is a pretty amazing site, and, you know, if it weren't for you, you know, the retro thing kind of makes me somebody again, so, you know, I like being who I am, but I also, you know, probably one of the best jobs I did was G.I. Joe.